Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is World Form Zen Fighting Champion John Chung, and you are listening to the AMAA Legends and Pioneers Radio Blog Show with Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives, protecting the history, one warrior at a time. Enjoy.
Aloha, everybody, and much mahalo to everybody who listens to the AMAA Masters Radio and Pioneer Show. My name is Professor Gary Lee, and I'm so excited tonight. Tonight is one of my most exciting shows, I think, that Hunter Bowen and I produced in a long, long time. And tonight we're going to be talking with some really incredible people. My special guests tonight are people like Daryl Stewart, Billy Sweeney, who was the medic for the MDL for 20 years. Daryl Stewart, by the way, was the arbitrator for 20 years. Mr. Dean Piles, who's a competitor for 30 years and then one of the top judges and competitor, not MDL, but competitor in the PKL days, Ms. Karen Fletcher. And then we'll be calling in the only man in the history of the sport to win four world championship super grand overall titles. That is pretty amazing. There's a woman who did it. Her name is Regina Thompson. We couldn't get her, but we do have Whitney Hicks. But right now, on the line, I have the one and only, the giant killer, John Natividad. John, are you there? John, is that you? Goodness gracious, I thought I had John on the phone. Okay, well, I got faked out like I always do. All those years I competed, I always got faked out. But you know what? I hope he calls back. I hope he gets on the line because I was excited to talk to him in the beginning part of the show. I'll try it one more time. John, that wasn't you that called in earlier? Okay. Well, we'll try to call back a little bit later. Well, tonight I have a very interesting show because I'll be talking about a league that was developed in the early 90s. The very first one was in Niagara Falls, then it moved to San Jose. Kind of got a low-key move about it, and then they went to Atlantic City. And they didn't call it Super Grand in Atlantic City. They called it a national tournament. It was the formation of the National Black Belt League. Well, that is what we're going to talk about tonight. And some of the things that has accumulated through the years of the NBL, NASCA, and all these leagues is recognition for people who've never really been said thank you to. And that is what's happening at the Legends Weekend at the American Martial Arts Alliance. Now, this is a Martial Arts Masters and Pioneers book release exclusive on June the 28th until 29th and the 19th, 2019, I'm sorry, at the Orleans Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. Now, we have a contest that will last until the 15th. Now, mind you, today's the 9th, so there's only a few days left. And that contest is very special. What happens is, if you take a chance to grab a total prize of $1,500, I'll say that again, take a chance to grab a total prize of $1,500, and the entry deadline is April 15th. Now, what's going to happen? You nominate your martial art hero, someone that you look up to, someone that you respect. You nominate that person, and you and your martial art hero win two-night stay at the New Orleans Hotel and Casino. Your hero receives our bronze inclusion package, and you have two tickets for the Super Show. That's right. For the Century Super Show, you'll receive two tickets. Now, for more information, submit your nomination. Call 919-618-8075 or contact amaawhoswho@gmail.com and tell them you heard it on the AMA Masters Radio Show. Thank you so much. And I appreciate you getting your nomination in quickly because the 15th is right around the corner. Well, on the line right now, I have Mr. Dean Piles, Mr. Billy Sweeney, Ms. Karen Slatcher, and I hope Daryl Stewart. Who do I have on the line right now? Tell me.
Daryl.
Billy here too.
I got Daryl.
Billy
Sweeney
is here.
Yes, I'm here. We're right here. Yes.
Okay. I'm going to try to control this mayhem of having you guys on the line at the same time. First of all, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. All of you guys know me in a very special way. Some of you in a very personal way, some of you in a teaching way, some of you in a crazy way, but most of you met me through the NBL in those early years. And those early years is very important to me personally. I'm very proud of my NBL history. But the NBL is a interesting vehicle. And by the way, people who don't understand, the NBL means National Black Belt League. And it was formed by a man named Boyce Liddell. Now, his vision was to put together a sport karate league and put together people who had the vision of making sport karate popular in America. Now, we're talking about early 90s. It's now 2019, so we're talking about a long time ago. But even then, karate was still in its raw ages compared to what it is to now. Now, the people I'm talking tonight, and I'm going to do them one at a time, they all have history. And I'd like to start off, first of all, with Billy Sweeney, who is was the medic for the NBL for how many years, Billy?
Long time.
Well,
my first one was Atlantic City, matter of fact.
92? Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So that does, and that was the one that, that I debuted in also.
I wasn't
now,
the medic
Darryl,
there,
you...
but I was there.
Okay, you weren't a medic?
No, I wasn't the medic then, but I was there.
Well, I don't care. I'm talking about, I want to talk to you as a medic.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm kidding. When did you start being a medic for the NBL?
My first foray into medic was probably Colorado.
Okay. That was 97.
Yeah.
Yeah, 97. Right. Now, Darryl,
Colorado,
when did you come
first.
In? When did you come in to be the arbitrator? I know that you took over my job, but I forgot what year that was. It was so long ago. What year was that?
97, Colorado.
Okay, so that was a long time ago. So so that's when you took it over from what I was doing. And then now, Karen, when was your first judging of an NBL event? What year? Karen?
You talking?
I'm sorry. I was talking.
Okay.
Okay,
you're
early.
Being punished now. 50 push-ups for not answering the phone. Okay. When was your first?
I was being polite.
When was your first NBL tournament that you judged at?
It was probably around 1995, 96, back in those days. And it was on the East Coast, so it was either Philadelphia, Maryland, or Atlantic City. I don't really remember which one, but that seemed to be where they had the events then.
Cool. So we've all established that we all started in the early years. And like Billy said, he'd been to the medic in 92, but he was there, and he understands what I'm about ready to say. It was 92 was an interesting year in Atlantic City because, one, it was really the first gathering, even though NASA was being formed too, but it was the first gathering of competitors literally from all around the country in a long time at a major event. That's the first thing I remember when I was doing my history tonight. And almost every state, Guatemala, of course, and Canada, Mexico, it was really represented. It was like a mini world championship before it became a world championship. But the one of the questions I wanted to ask this group, and it's kind of a magic question, and I want to get each one's opinion of it, especially you, Darryl, because you've done it every year, and you too, Billy. Why do you guys feel about having it every Christmas? I mean, that was every Christmas that you wouldn't spend it with your family. You had to take care of Christmas before you left or when you came back. But every Christmas – oh, no, in the beginning it was Thanksgiving. I'm sorry. It was
it bounced back and forth.
Every Christmas. Yeah. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about that being on every Christmas and Thanksgiving?
Well, my family's used to it because I celebrate before that, and then I leave usually on Christmas Day or the day after. And so it was either Thanksgiving or Christmas, but most of the kids are off at Christmas. So, you know, it kind of works out better for the kids and the parents, both, in my opinion.
Well, my family would drive me crazy. I still get dirty looks from Tammy. If I even mention I'm going to a karate tournament near Christmas. Billy, how do you feel about it? Because you were committed sometimes even a month before the tournament.
Yeah, it's usually a month. Usually my attendance was usually a month. It was the whole month of December. I usually got there about the 17th or 18th of December, and I stayed until about January the 11th. And it's tough. I mean, I hated being away from family and stuff, but I understood why that event was held then, and that was because the hotel rooms were cheaper.
Right.
You know, and, you know, especially in some of the places we were at during the wintertime, it's all season for most hotels. And it didn't bother me, but it was like we formed another family there. We had Christmas. We celebrated Christmas or Thanksgiving if it was on Thanksgiving, and we had one Super Grand that happened in January, and that was San Antonio. Usually that month I'm there, it was work. So,
Dean, how do you feel about it?
Well, I mean, you know, it was a good time to have it. I mean, my family always thought that I just didn't want to be around at Thanksgiving or Christmas, so I made up that there was a karate tournament. They just couldn't believe that there was a karate tournament at Thanksgiving or at Christmas every year. And my kids, they grew up, you know, at the NBL Super Grands. I mean, that's where they spent every Christmas. You know, so they were just kind of used to it. They didn't even get a real Christmas till they were up almost, you know, 20 years old.
I remember seeing them there, Dean, all your kids growing up.
Yeah. They grew up right there. I mean, that's where they grew up at.
Well, the next question I want to ask now, Karen, you when you judged that tournament in Christmas in Philadelphia, was it Christmas or Thanksgiving?
I don't remember it being either one of them because I wouldn't have been there. I was very involved in my church, so I would have been the choirs and everything would have been involved.
It was that way for years, so
I wouldn't have liked that.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you guys another question dealing with that kind of history. You know, it was not a one-day, two-day tournament. We had to commit ourselves for a whole week. Sometimes because we were all competitors, except for Daryl and Billy, he competed too, I believe. Being a competitor, you had to be there all week, especially if you were there as a judge, because you had to be at the meetings every morning. How do you guys feel like committing yourself for a whole week just for one tournament? Not that I don't mind. I'm just telling. I'm asking your opinion, Billy.
Tournaments are, I mean. The reason I like them so much is because it was a tournament and it was like a family environment. But a week
Someone's got background noise. Someone's got background noise.
Yeah. There was a being there for 5 days was not bad because seeing the competition is just as much fun as competing, and that was what made it so great is that you could watch others. I mean, if you won. You had to compete again a couple of days later. But, you know, it's being able to see all the competition during the week and the amount and the talent was what made being there a five-day tournament so neat.
Yes, that's a good
answer. It just added a new element. You know, during a day and one-day tournament, you don't get to see everybody compete if you're competing, you know.
Right.
And but a five-day tournament, you see so much talent from all over the world. It's amazing.
Well, speaking of talent, let's talk about some of that talent. Daryl and Karen and Billy, let's start with Karen first. Karen, do you remember some of the competitors you saw back then that really impressed you?
I remember seeing a couple of the women competitors that were outstanding, absolutely outstanding, and I had never seen them before. I was on the PKO circuit for years. And I stopped competing in like 93. And so I didn't know when I went back and helped at this tournament, I didn't know a lot of the women there and they were amazing. But I sat there, I was judging these girls and I could not believe how they acted toward the judges. And I had to sit back a couple times and say, what is this? Because one of the girls, her final bow-out move was blowing a kiss to the judge, and they liked it. And I said, what the hell is this?
No, you're lying. You're You're
no,
lying
I'm
to
not.
Me from Gary Lee. You're lying to me. Don't say
no,
that to me.
No, Gary,
they didn't
if I'm lying, I'm flying.
Joke.
If I'm lying, I'm flying. And that's when I said, you know what, I don't think I can do this. I'm too much of a traditionalist. But they were they dressed almost in an alluring way in their uniforms. And the people that I saw competing were changing uniforms 3 or 4 times. Throughout the day, they competed in any division they had a uniform for. I never saw such a thing in my life. Being a traditionalist, it was very difficult for me.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, you're what I call a bi karate guy. Don't take that offensively. Because you're a Sean Roof animal, Karen, which is hardcore karate do. And then you're also a kung fu qi kung person, that which is pretty cool, and that to me is, and like I said, when I say bye, it means that you do both. That's all. Okay, so with that said, Billy, who are some of your favorite competitors that you've seen through the years? I know you've seen quite a few. Who are some of your favorites?
Well, the very first one that I got impressed with was Butch Tuigasala. He just blew my mind. And the way he competed and his fierceness and his competitiveness. And I remember Michelle Krasnew. She was a big then. We had a lot of great, great, great competitors. And some of them are actually coming back. You know, Keith Weston came back this last year. And he was, you know, he was always a big, big one you wanted to go watch. You always wanted to watch him compete. I mean, I watched a lot of kids grow up through the years. I mean, Sage Northcutt, you know, and his sister. And you watch kids grow up. Joshua Durbin went from like a 4-year-old and he was still competing in his 20s. I mean, it's you kind of watch martial artists grow up. And I'm kind of a traditional stylist like Karen is. I only compete traditional style. But seeing some of the dynamic stuff was kind of neat.
Cool. Daryl, who are some of your favorite competitors, buddy?
Well, Adrian Ulanoff, remember him? He was such a class act. He was really way ahead of his time. Corky Seitz, Dan Baker, you know, there were so many. It's just the guy from Mexico. Oh, I can see his face.
Edgar.
I just went. Edgar.
Edgar Cordova.
What an
he's from Guatemala.
Yeah, he's one of Eric's boys.
You
mentioned a lot of cool names, and like I said, I've seen a lot of those kids grow up. Kobe, you mentioned Kobe Northcutt, and of course Seiji, who's done an amazing job. But, you know, I'm thinking about fighters like Raymond Daniels and Willie Hicks, and competitors like Jeff Goff.
He had a plethora
of only
them.
Won. Jeff Goff is the only man in forms competition in the world who's ever won 4 overall Super Grand World titles. And all the opportunities of all the other kata competitors from 20 years or whatever, they had an opportunity to do that, but Jeff did it. And the other two fighters that I mentioned earlier in the show was Regina Thompson and Willie Hicks. And Willie right now is trying to call in. I hope he gets through to Jesse Bowen, to Mr. Bowen.
I hope I do,
but,
too.
Oh, are you there, Willie?
He's there.
Hey, Willie. How you doing?
He made it.
Willie.
Are we losing?
Well, we thought he was in.
Willie, can you hear me? I thought you guys said he was there.
That sounded like him.
I guess he's not. Okay. Well, he's trying to call in, I know.
What about Casey Marks and Trevor Nash? And
Trevor Nash was a good one.
Absolutely. The fighting was incredible. The forms competition was incredible. And the overall basis of doing all these events was incredible. Now, we've established it was a great league. We've established it's a longevity league. It's been there for a long time. But with any league that survives, there is turmoil. And in turmoil, I immediately think of the people that have left the NBL, whether they didn't get along with the rules changes, the rule changing, or problem with the judges and the overall attitude of the tournament. Now, I'm going to – this is called Parts Unknown. You guys know me. I don't pull punches. So I'm going to ask some really hard questions. And the first question I'm going to deal with is about judging. And since I've got the head arbitrator and I've got a competitor who is also the medic and also one of the top judges, you guys, I hope you understand my question. So here's my first question. How important it is to change those rules every year as the NBL did and change it? I'll give you an example. When they did it in Niagara Falls and they added the weights to all the weapons, a lot of people didn't know about it because there was no free app to tell people about it. It's just kind of word of mouth thing. So I was there. I was one of the competitors. When we got there, we were hit with it. A lot of people were disqualified immediately because they were using two-pick bows. A lot of things happened. But how do you feel, Daryl, about the rule changes quickly, or do they do it within a time frame that people don't know about and still want to compete? It's kind of a competing question, but I think you understand what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, well, I didn't realize I was at Niagara Falls. I think the second time when it was freezing, of course, it's always cold there anyway, but I didn't realize that rule had just went in effect that year. But, you know, since then, I mean, you know, you have to institute rules somewhere. And if that happened and everybody didn't know about it, well, you know, that's a bad thing. You know, if they did know about it and act like they didn't know it, that's another thing. So, you know, which way was it? You know, I think it's a good thing because the toothpick bow against a heavy weapon, you know, I mean, you can sling that toothpick bow like it's in nothing in air. You get a flagstaff bow, well, that's a lot harder to manipulate.
Well, they needed to separate creative from traditional, and that was a good point. But when they started saying the commas had to be a certain weight, the toppers had to be a certain weight, the sides had to be a certain weight, it had to be a certain length. They got really, because really when Kabuto was formed, it was farm tools, period. Farm tools. And it wasn't about size and weight. It was about protecting yourself against the sword. So people have forgotten that code. But that's okay. I understand. Now, my second question I want to ask is that one of the rules, I think it was in Savannah, and it was real controversial. You are a big part of this, Daryl. You were a big part of this because TNT was being formed in, and the rule was you didn't have to be a black belt to be a judge anymore. One of the most controversial rules I believe the NBL ever changed. How do you feel about that, Karen? First of all, then I'll call you, Daryl.
I think that's garbage. It's terrible. How could you?
Even
not?
If they're trained, even if they listen, I'm going to defend Daryl for a minute. Even if they're trained in clinics, where they're trained to know the rules, understand the rules, and do they have to be black belts? And on top of that, how many people who are skaters who are judges of ice skating? How many people are judges in other sports like boxing but aren't really boxers? So that's the contradiction on that, but I understand your point too because I understand. I was a competitor. But go ahead and say your point about being garbage. Be more specific.
I just think that in order for the art to stay as fair as possible, you have to have trained judges that are neutral. And you start bringing in teachers and parents and things like that, or brothers and sisters who used to keep score and now they feel that they can judge. No.
Wait a minute, you're telling me that a father of a competitor that was competing would be a judge? I understand that the scorekeepers and timekeepers. But a judge, a competition that someone has paid competition for, and he should have stepped out, correct? Now, I know I'm being contradicted. I'm not contradicted by being sarcastic. How do you feel about that? Let Daryl speak. You come back. Go, Daryl, go ahead.
Okay, let me just say this. These people that become judges, they had to sit in class for a long time, and they had to pass this test. And if they didn't pass these tests, and if they couldn't go, and we even did it at ringside where they had to judge, and they had to look at all this, and we talked about all these rules and how to do them. And, you know, just because somebody's a black belt doesn't mean that they're a good judge.
They don't do that now, Daryl. Daryl, they don't do that now, and that rule still is in effect. You don't have to be a black belt to judge an NBL tournament. They don't have clinics. I know they don't have clinics.
No, they have to be a black belt.
They do have clinics?
Oh, yeah.
Some tournaments will give clinics for some of the judges, but that don't mean your judges are going to show up to the clinics.
Wait a minute. I thought Willie wasn't here. Is that Willie?
That's Willie Hicks, the one and only.
Willie Hicks, man.
Yes,
hey,
sir.
Willie, how are you? For the listeners who are just coming on, who are listening to me, my big mouth, I've got Willie Hicks on the phone. He's actually my adopted son. But Willie Hicks won the Super Grands overall world championship 4 times. Willie, thank you for being on the show, buddy. How you doing?
Thank you for having me, Professor. I'm doing well. Doing pretty well.
Well, I'm pops to you. I'm not Professor. You know that. So listen to me. Tell me, since you've been fighting since you were a baby, but you grew up in the NBL, I want your opinion on the fact of the judging and not being a black belt. I want your opinion on that.
Yes, I have grew up on the NBL, and I have watched it time to deteriorate, starting with the judging, the controversies with instructors judging their students. Now we have the parents not only doing tiekeeper, but they can go sit in a chair as long as they know the rules, supposedly as long as they know the rules. But now we've been to a few NBL tournaments to where it wasn't enough judges. And if it was so-and-so's tournament, they will get a few of their parents out of the crowd to come sit down and judge. You know, I feel like the black belts, with us fighting for money, I feel like we're pros. So I feel like at all times we should have professional judges who know the rules. There's no way that any competitor should argue with a judge about a call because they made the wrong call. One thing I like about overseas is that the judges must call the same technique or it's no point. You have some judges calling 3, 2, 1, and then you ask them, what are you calling, what are you calling, what are you calling? They're all not calling the same thing. But it's going to be 1 point.
We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that in a minute, but I want to hit one more constructive criticism from Dean Piles before I go back to Daryl Stewart. Dean, tell me your opinion on how you feel non-black belts.
Right. So, yeah, because y'all kept skipping me. So now the Wolverine's got to weigh in. Okay, so going back to Dale and their favorite competitor, it was me. That's who their favorite competitor was.
Ah, wow.
but, you know, also during those Super Grand years, I want to brag on Alex for a minute. She's the only person to beat Johnny Murphy 4 times, 4 straight Super Grands in a row, being the overall champion, points champion of the Super Grand, Trump Titan, Boyce's card. So that's pretty big that a lot of people don't talk about.
Alex, too.
With the points thing? With the points thing?
Too.
Or with the,
Alex,
with the judging? The what?
Wolverine.
Alex Powell.
Wolverine. Alex, who?
Alex Powell.
Who's that?
That's my daughter. He's the only one. That's why I left the NBA. Look, you can't get any recognition for nothing you do in there half of the time.
No, you
but
cannot.
This is the thing. With the judges, what Mr. Stewart was doing was great. The problem is a lot of the judges, even though they're black belts, judge on the way they do it at their dojo or their dojang instead of judging by Boyce's rule book. The rule book
he had was
good.
Wolverine, stop. Solitaire. Now, I've got to give Mr. Stewart, because he's the arbitrator for the past 20 years, a slight rebuttal on this, because we bombarded him with 2 constructive criticisms there. But I want to say one more point before I give it to Daryl. And that point is that it's okay, I understand what went on, but what Daryl did with TNT was in the early 90s. It's 2019. You cannot tell me. If you do, I apologize, that they have clinics with people who are non-black belts to get them ready to judge black belt competition, which Willie said earlier, they are semi-pros because they are fighting for money. So why should they be judged by a parent that is judging their own son who's in the Super Grand, and it's just not unethical. So, Daryl, you've been hit with a lot of stuff, man. Hit me. Tell me what you feel.
So are you with me now?
Yeah, I'm with you, Daryl. We picked on you a little bit. It's your turn.
Well, you know, I don't know right at the moment in the last year or two that when you say they're pulling parents out of the stands to judge, because I judge with a lot of different tournaments, and normally, you know, these are black belts now. I haven't been given my clinics for TNT in probably 15 years now. So I don't know, Willie, where are you seeing these people that they're pulling out of the stands to judge? I mean, I hadn't judged with those people, so I mean, I don't know.
You know, Mr. Stewart, of course, we definitely do a lot of different tournaments. So nobody's turning under the bus because I might have enjoyed, or I might have had one with that parent being in there. But I definitely have lost with the parent being in there, too, who don't know the rules. I have definitely lost that. I have lost with kids being at tournaments with parents who's judging their own kids. I mean, literally, their sons and daughters.
Yeah.
You know, and
I know it doesn't happen. I mean,
I'm talking about national events. NBL national events is what I'm speaking of, where we'd have paid all this money to go down here to your event to get these points for this big world championship that we're trying to get at the end of the year, to lose first round because a parent called a kid inbounds when the kid's out of bounds. When you lift your leg up and one foot's out, one foot's in, and you lift your leg up, that's you're out of bounds. But
yeah,
it wasn't my tournament, so I couldn't argue that down. And nor were you there, Mr. Stewart, so I didn't have you to argue it down.
Yeah, because that.
Well,
you know, I mean...
It's just one of many things, guys, that are brought up through the years of the NBL. Now let's hit another point, and that point is in fighting. There's all these different point levels. As most people know in this group, which is an old timer group, pioneers, even you, Willie, being a young man, but you've been fighting forever.
Yeah.
Remember when it was 1 point for everything?
Of course, I was around.
Roy Turbin invented the 2-point kick in the Fort Worth Pro-Am, and then Mr. Lydell invented it with the NBL, a 3-point kick, which was very controversial. You had to be in the air, turn your body, you had to whatever, and you couldn't hit the head. If you did the head, it was complicated. So now it was bad enough, but it was hard enough for the competitors to learn those 3-point, 2-point, 1-point. But now the judges who were responsible to be accurate as they could, they didn't really understand that, too, unless they went to those meetings. But the people who didn't go to Super Grands didn't go to those meetings. And those people who did the national tournaments or the little regional tournaments, they were just going on hearsay. Tell me your feeling about that. Let's get Billy's opinion on how the rule – the point levels of different levels. Was that harder or easier, you think, through the years?
Let alone for especially judges, it's different. I mean, when I see fighters go up there and they have their time's running out and they do a cartwheel kick and that's 3 points, I mean, who in their right mind is going to do a cartwheel kick in any fight? Because you're off balance, you're in trouble at that point. I mean, I think the 1 and 2 is okay because you're doing a little bit of effort by jumping or kicking to the head or anything like that. I think that requires it. When you show the skill and it connects, you should get those points. But 3 points, I kind of have a little doubt about the 3 points. I like the 1 and 2 point better.
So, Karen, what do you think about it? Did you ever call 3-point kick in your career?
I had to judge that day, the day that I was there judging, and the 1, 2, and 3-point kicks was very difficult to judge for an old timer like me that was just used to throwing up a hand, you know, and saying point here. It was
right.
Hard. So I can't imagine if you're pulling, let's say, inexperienced judges out of the stands. I can't see how it could be fair, because it's just not. It's hard enough when you're used to judging, and you're sharp.
Yeah.
To say exactly what kick came in, what did that kick look like, that kind of thing. And it was a lot of pressure, I think, on all of us.
Dean Wolverine, when you were fighting, did you hit people with 3-point kicks? Or, I mean,
yes,
was it
I did. And, you know, this is the thing. The 1 and 2-point kicks are good. And boys had all the rules written out pretty simple. You could go online and download them. I studied that rule book inside and out. But for a competitor, that can has the dynamic to do the aerial kicks. That's what we live for. Is, you know, you we set you up, you can be down, bam, you get a 3-point kick, bam, bam, you ahead 6 points quick off of being dynamic and landing those techniques. And it wasn't that the technique, it was just a regular side kick or something. You're talking about people landing 270s, 360s, you know, things like that. Those techniques require timing and a lot of coordination to land that kick right and precise. So, you know, and taking up for Boyce a little bit there, it made it exciting because when people were down, you got to start seeing more dynamic technique coming out. And it made Billy's job a lot harder because, you know, sometimes it'd be some injuries. But, you know, that was the thing that was out that Boyce had put out in that rule book. Everybody should have known it a long time, but it just made fights a lot better. And now things have got boring with fights because the only move used is blitz, 1-2, blitz, 1-2. So now the judges, they see somebody move and throw their lead hand up and move their backhand a hair. They go, break, and they call a point, and everybody even got hit yet.
Let me get Gerald's opinion on the 3-point kick or the 3-point points. How do you feel about Gerald, since you deal with it a lot?
I've been doing them all for a long time, and I've been through the 1 and 2 points and the 3 points. And to me, the 3-point kick, if you can pull something like that off, you have to be really good to be able to do that. I mean, that's not a sloppy technique. If it is, the judges aren't worth a damn. But I mean, if Willie Hicks, you pull a lot of these kicks off, am I right or wrong, sir? And you do a great job doing it.
You are right. You are definitely right. And it's just times where I hit people and didn't land and did not get that point for it.
That's right. But, I mean, on the other side of that, as Billy said, you can step up and get 3 points, and then you blitz and get one or you get two. And if you're down, you got a chance to come back. It makes the fight exciting to me instead of just 1-2 and a blitz and throwing your hand up.
Well, guys,
you know?
I got to share something.
I agree.
Okay? Give me a minute here to share something with you. A week ago, I went and covered the USK Grand Nationals for 3 days, and that's the oldest karate tournament in the country that's still running by the same group. Long Beach has been around a long time. Battle Line has been a long time, but the USK Grand Nationals has been around since 1964 when Trias invented the USKA. Now, when they broke up, and Mr. Capel and Mr. Ischini and Mr. Bowles all went their separate way, they still kept the bulk of the USK Alliance, and that was ran by Jim Hawks and Dr. David Jordan, who are all passed now. Now it's run by Mr. Buster Cotton and Captain Davis, but still it's the bulk of the USKA. Now, why am I mentioning the United States Karate Association? Because they still fight, believe it or not, 1 point. They still wear all-white uniforms. They still fight in a way that's really interesting, because they fight, and they don't stop the fight just because someone fakes or touches or hits one time. I saw 8 or 10 fights that weekend where they were hitting each other pretty good, but they weren't impressing the 4 seasoned judges, and no points went up. I haven't seen that in a long time in any NASCA, NBL, AOK, any tournament, and I was really rejuvenated. So there is the old flavor still there, and there's some people who don't even think about 3-point or even 2-point. So I appreciate you guys talking about that subject.
Hey,
I have another subject
professor.
I'd like to talk.
Professor, hang on. But did anyone at that competition throw any dynamic kicks to get 1 point, like any aerial kicks to the head or anything like that?
The beautiful wheel kicks, the beautiful hook kick execution, the beautiful low high round kick execution, and I'm not talking about touch, come close. I'm talking about didn't rock the head back,
landed.
They got hit, and it was beautiful. it rejuvenated my attitude to know that there's real karate do still in America. And I'm not cutting down the NBL, I'm not cutting down NASCAR, I'm not cutting down AK, but I'm telling you that the fighting is different, and there's still a group that still fights in real point karate kumite. So let's go to another.
I can tell you why. That sounds like a You come from the medical side of that, and you have full contact tournaments. Your insurance goes up. Excuse me.
I didn't say full contact, Billy. I didn't say full contact.
Or you make contact.
I said good control kumite, okay, with light contact to the body and no contact to the face. I didn't say full contact. See, that's the difference between a lot of people who are.
Tell him, Billy, you had to disqualify somebody for a body shot. And it's Texas.
No, don't be teasing me.
Okay.
Don't tell me you just thought about somebody's body shot.
I want Billy to explain that so we can understand some of the rules that we deal with.
Billy, you're lying. Don't be lying on my radio show. Don't be telling
Billy
me that someone was
had
disqualified
to disqualify
for
a
body contact.
It wasn't me that disqualified.
Say it again.
No, it did not. It did not. When you were down at Luis's tournament. I talked to the guy that got disqualified.
Okay, stop. Hey, guys, stop. Stop. Okay, I want to ask a question. In an open karate competition, Willie Hicks, did you see somebody get disqualified for hitting the body too hard?
Yes, sir, I did.
And who disqualified that person?
Billy Sweeney had to make a judgment call.
No. No.
Okay.
There's only one judgment call I make, and that is whether you can.
Oh, who made the call then, Billy? Who made the call?
It was the arbitrator, Leo Heft, that made the disqualification.
Okay, so we got to go after Leo Heft.
The only decision I can't disqualify anybody. The only decision I can make is whether you can continue or can't continue. That's the only decision I can make. I can never disqualify anybody from a competition.
Billy. Okay, you don't have to. Take up for yourself. I got to go back to the body shot. What on earth? What style did Leo Heft train in karate do where he even can think that someone would be disqualified for a body shot? What on earth caused that?
Well, it's the same thing as the blood rule. It's the same thing. If you're doing karate, there's going to be blood.
Wait, did he bleed by hitting him in the stomach?
No, but it's the same thing as the blood rule. Why do you think you're disqualified if you draw blood? Because if you're going to hit somebody, even white, you're going to bleed.
Wolverine.
Explain
to Mr. Sweeney why you shouldn't be disqualified by hitting the body compared to a blood shot.
I agree with everybody else. He shouldn't have got disqualified.
Okay.
There you go. I didn't even have to do it.
Good point.
Okay. All right, that's done then. Okay, that way we can move on.
Okay, that's
fine.
Well,
I argued with the promoter and Leo Heft. Why are you disqualifying him? It was a clean kick.
Willie, Mr. Hicks, Willie Hicks.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you a blunt question. What is the most outrageous thing you ever saw at a Super Grand if you won four overall championships and been to almost every one of them? What was the most outrageous thing you ever saw? I'm not just talking about a fight or a kata. Yeah, the most thing that really sticks in your mind about Super Grands.
Oh, that goes back to 1998 Super Grands, Savannah, Georgia, when Raymond cut his foot open and Mark Childress had cut Raymond's eye open that same week, and Raymond pulled that first place off in point fighting.
That was the first
Super Grands I ever been to. I think
I remember that.
Being in the hotel room and being able to look straight down at the stage, that was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
That's why in 2000, I did not wait to go back in 2000. And that's why I definitely made myself on that stage. And I think that was kind of a highlight for myself. But
wasn't
that in Savannah, Georgia?
Yes, sir.
Savannah,
Georgia.
Yeah, that was a good Savannah.
Daryl, what was your most memorable experience of Super Grand since you've been to all 20 of them, or all of them?
Probably when I was with Gary Lee up at Niagara Falls, and we were trying to get into the party and the deal that night, and it was outside. I mean, do you remember the stairway just trying to get in?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I remember. That was funny. You know, I'll save mine for last. What was your most experience, Billy?
Most outrageous experience? My favorite experience was, I mean, when Super Grand was really fun. We were in Panama City, and we were having a pre-party before the tournament started. We had a pre-party on the beach, a bonfire, and everything. All of a sudden, a pirate ship showed up and kidnapped everybody, and we all went for a ride in the bay. It was great.
Well,
I'm sorry?
I said, I don't remember that. I was there. I must have missed the damn boat.
You missed the boat.
Hey, guys, let me share with you something that's really cool. And I thought about this question, and I wanted to share it with my friends. 1992, you know, George Minshew, and we were all coming from Texas up there to Atlantic City, and we were all nervous. I was extremely nervous. But I realized that there was no money involved except for one event. And Voice was going to give back the money for the creative on-the-spot musical kata. I forgot what they called it. And
there's a musical challenge.
That's it, musical challenge. And I told Scott Hogarth, I said, I want to win this. I don't care how we win it, but I want to win it. And Scott says, well, you know, he's giving away the money back, but it's going to be hard to meet a lot of people there. And I said, okay, well, I got an idea, but do me a favor, Scott. Would you please wear your best-looking suit and shirt? And he looked at me like I was crazy, which I was, and he goes, why? I said, I want to see what you look like good. I mean, you've been wearing a uniform all day. And we're talking about Scott Hogarth, who's the head arbitrator of the NBL, okay? So,
and a little bitty guy.
Yeah, big guy, yeah. Anyway, so he shows up in a Louis Ross suit, which was probably $1,000, got a really nice shirt, and I didn't tell nobody what I was going to do, and I hid the banana in my gi, and the judges lined up, and I realized that Voice didn't give no money away except for this event, and it came out to be $146 and some odd cents that he was going to give to the first place winner. Well, they played the music Born to be Wild. And I went out there and I grabbed Scotty by the nose, dragged him out in the middle of the floor, swept him, ripped his shirt open, broke a board over his head first, put the cucumber on his groin and his stomach and on his neck, and cut it. Everybody thought I was – they didn't – even Scotty didn't know what I was going to do, but he went along with it. And then I took the banana. Of course, I did the great banana button, bit the banana. But I took that $146. And God bless Glenn Kwan. Remember Glenn Kwan, Daryl? Glenn Kwan?
Yeah.
God bless Glenn Kwan, my dear friend from Hawaii. Glenn Kwan and Daryl Stewart and I went to the other side of Atlantic City, the seated side, the side that you don't really want to be at, right? And we walked through that area, and we spent that $146 on breakfast that morning, and we stayed till about 4 o'clock in the morning until we had to leave. And that's my most memorable bit of Super Grands, doing that to Scott Hogarth, which is a super, super guy. Now, Karen, you, how many Super Grands have you been to, honey?
I don't believe I went to any. I after seeing her blow the kiss, I was done. That's it.
Okay. So you're just an old fogey that didn't want to go with any new leagues, right?
That's exactly it. That's me.
Cool. Well, I'm going to ask a really magic question here, and this is kind of an important question, and this is for all the guests, and we'll take it one at a time. We'll start with Billy. The question is, in the beginning, it was the USKA, and then, of course, all the Taekwondo leagues, and then AOK, then the AKBBA, and then NASCA, and then the NBL formed from NASCA, and then you had all these different groups pop up. And now you got literally hundreds of organizations that offer sport karate and avenues. How do you feel, and I'm talking to everybody, I'm going to let everybody answer, how do you feel about all these different associations and what they offer, and what makes the NBL different from all these organizations through the years? Billy?
Well, I mean, yeah, I hear people all the time say, well, there's too many leagues. Really, that's not an issue. I mean, if they're fun, and you want to compete in them, go compete in them. They're, I mean, a lot of them are, you know, have their own unique style and stuff like that. I mean, some of them are better than the others, I think, in my opinion. But what drew me to stay with the NBL so long, the way it was produced, it was different. It was going to be a different theme every time. And it was just, yeah, of course, it's not like that now, but it was something to come to. It was like going to Disneyland every year, and it was different every year. And
Willie, give me your opinion. What about all the leagues? Did you play everywhere, every place?
Just like Billy said, it was different. I think what grasped me more was the magazine, making the picture. Those things were something that we competitors look forward to trying to reach as one of our goals. You know, one of my definite goals was always to make the front cover of the magazine. I always wanted to be in the small box or the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, super grandes, I always wanted to make sure that my pictures and that my school was represented. You know, that right there.
I agree with that too.
Look forward to come to do it. Then as that started to go away, you know, it just kind of dried out. So the next kid, the next generation didn't have anything to look forward to. And I think that's where we're at with super grands now, is that nobody has anything to look forward to that's different like it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I'm going to bring up a hard, parts unknown question. Maybe Daryl can answer this question. I don't know if he knows or not, but how much money did you have to pay to be on the cover of the magazine?
How much money did you pay to be on the cover
how
of the magazine?
How much money did you have to pay, Mr. Lydell? I won't stutter. How much money did anybody have to pay Mr. Lydell to be on the cover of the magazine? Or how was the process?
Wow. I don't know. I was never on the cover of the magazine.
I have never heard that at all.
I made the small box. I made the small box, and I think I just paid as to just being a loyal customer, I would call it, not even a competitor, a customer. Because that's what competitors became.
So
customers
he didn't
to
charge. Mr. Lydell didn't charge people to be on the cover. Or they didn't have to sell so many magazine subscriptions.
Of course.
Or they didn't have to advertise in the magazine to be on the cover. He just picked them randomly for who they were. It was his decision only.
Was there exciting? No. It was their exciting year. I mean, if they did a lot during the Super Grands, I mean, of course they were going to make the cover. And if they did a lot, of course, there were stories from all over the country from all the tournaments. And if they were doing good in tournaments and making good national points, then they made it the cover.
Well, Billy, let me tell you something. Billy, in the way of the magazine, of publishing world, to make a cover of a magazine, you either publisher who are publishers for the person, for the celebrity, gets it done through sponsorship, or, for instance, in our cases, being a martial artist, normally the person, the publisher, offers us so many, we have to sell so many subscriptions or get so many people involved with getting the magazine and offer to be on the cover. So I wonder what was behind the scenes for those various people who got on the cover. I'm sure a lot of them earned it.
Nothing. I'm just a good competitor. I mean, the magazine was free to everybody.
Well, I got a question then. I'm not going to mention names, because I promise you guys. Billy, I'm not going to mention names, but I just want to ask a question. There were some people that were always in that magazine. Every issue. And you know, I don't believe in hearsay. I don't believe what people say. But I'm just curious. You know, that magazine was a monopoly because it didn't make people feel good.
No. If that magazine was still around today, Willie Hicks would be in that magazine every quarter. I guarantee it. Because he does well at competition. He wins.
And so would the arbitrators for each state. So I was in a lot of
that's right. All the arbitrators for each conference.
All the arbitrators.
Okay, I got a little background noise, guys. Okay, well, good. That answers that question, I guess, to a little degree.
Hey, but let me say something. In my opinion, all of the kids wanted to be in that magazine. I told Boris that was the best thing that he had ever done. Because believe me,
it is.
Every kid.
I was
wanted
in that magazine a lot,
and
I wasn't even a competitor.
Okay, why'd they stop it?
Am I right or wrong?
Because not cost effective because they charged more for printing it.
Yeah. Willie, did you want to be in that magazine?
Sir, I made sure before that magazine disappeared, I was on that magazine.
That's what I'm
That's right. He was.
You were happy to be in that magazine, wasn't you? Wasn't you happy to be in there?
Oh yeah, yes, sir. And I think the karate world got to see who I was, not only as a competitor, but who I was as
a person.
You know, the write up, you know, the stories, all that.
You know,
it was just so amazing. I think that's what kept me around and wanting to go to Super
Dragon.
Hello. You had something
to look forward to. Hello. Let me make a positive statement, and I don't know if you guys even know this or not, but you know, Mr. Lydell and I, we had a kind of like a love hate relationship.
I'm on.
But I really respect him deeply for what he did for our sport, and what the NBL is still doing for us with the great new promoters like Corky Sykes and Brian Pena and other people throughout the country who are still believing in the NBL. But I want to say something to Boyce's character. You know, people came down on him a lot, and I understand that he had to stand up for various things. But when I created the Sport Karate Museum, I sat with him and talked to him for about an hour. And I talked to him from the heart. And a week later, he sent me a magazine from every issue that he put out. That's a true story. So there's a nice part about Boyce Lydell that people don't realize. I mean, he didn't have to do that. And it'll be always in the archives, each, every one of those magazines, because of what he did. And he did that because you guys know Boyce. He didn't really do things like that. But he did for the museum, and I appreciate that. So with that beginning, I want to ask you guys a question, and I'll start with Daryl. How important – now, I'm going to start with Karen because she's the lady in the group. Karen.
Okay.
How important is the Sport Karate Museum archives and the work that we've done for 20 years, this being the celebration of 20 years? How important is the Great Panda?
It's very important. It's our shining light. It's our little lighthouse that we have that places I can send pictures to and places that we can
Tell them what you just sent me.
I found a picture of Grandmaster Peter Urban and Richard Kim and Don Warren are all standing together.
Tell them what I have from you, though. I have the original suitcase that Mr. Urban carried around with him and the manuscript of a book that – was that published or was it published?
It never was published.
Yeah. See, that's what makes it special. I have it. I have it. I can touch it right now. I have it. Isn't that cool?
Well, that's where
it Peter Urban is the actual – Peter Urban, for the people who are listening, he was actually the actual first legitimate, self-proclaimed 10th-degree black belt. He went to Japan and faced Yamaguchi, Goshi Yamaguchi, and Yamaguchi said, no, you can't be a 10th-degree black belt in Goju. No. But Mr. Urban came back to America and – bucked the system, became a 10th-degree black belt, and actually became the first one in America. The second one was Kurimala, who better known as who fought Mr. Jeff Smith in the Thrill of Manila. So 10th-degree black belts, even though they're a dime a dozen now, the Sport Karate Museum knows who the very first one was. Daryl, you're next. How important is the Sport Karate Museum? You've been a part of it for the very beginning. You're one of the original history generals for the Sport Karate Museum. And let me tell you this before you answer the question. I had a guy call me the other day, and he's pretty popular in California, and he goes like this. Hey, man, anybody can be a history general. How important are they? You always talk about they're doing this, they do that, but a history general, anybody can be it. I see anybody can be one. And I just hung up on the guy because the guy was a jerk. You're a history general, one of the original ones. How important is it to be part of that in the Sport Karate Museum or just be part of it?
Well, I feel really great to be a history general and be associated with the Museum of Sports Karate for the last 20 years because of the people that I have had the opportunity to meet throughout my lifetime and the people that support the museum and what they do and how we remember all of our people from years ago, and if it wasn't for that, I don't know that anybody would ever even be recognized anymore. I mean, we got to have something, and the Museum of Sports Karate is a great avenue for that, and you do a great job in all the history, gentlemen, and all the people I've got to meet through the 20 years is just amazing to me, the amount of knowledge that we have to get back to.
Yeah, you've seen in detail all the incredible memorabilia that I've collected for 20 years. It's pretty amazing when you think about it, isn't it? I mean, all the incredible stuff. Yeah. And speaking of amazing stuff, Mr. Hicks, I have Willie Hicks's his 2013 Super Grand's overall world championship belt and his first place fighting belt in the museum. Willie, give me your opinion. How important is that the people 30 years from now know who Willie Hicks is? Tell me how important it is.
It's important. It's very important to me, especially since the museum is kind of all we have left right now to kind of recognize, you know, the people that came before me who kept these doors open for us to have these opportunities. Without the museum, we really wouldn't know too much about what's going on, especially with the Texas sport karate that's going around.
Well, I appreciate that. And Billy? Tell me your opinion on how important it is for the Sport Karate Museum to exist. And you're a big part of it because one of the things we did 2 years ago, we came up with a vision to create these incredible posters that we put out around the country. And everyone's really responsive. We hero posters. And, of course, you help with every year what I do with the museum. But I want your opinion on how important the Sport Karate Museum is important to you personally and to the people you work with.
Well, I mean, it's very vital for our sport and everything else because of all the young people coming up in the sport now can see where this came from, where sport karate really originated, how these people came about. But I think the museum is more than the artifacts that you get. I think it's more of a living museum. It's the people. When you go to the living legend and you listen to these people that, you know, fought bare-knuckled back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it's amazing just to listen. And you say, wow, look how much it's just pushed the sport. And I think it's vital to every youngster out there coming into sport karate to see some of this stuff that you've gathered and to see meet these people and to really speak to them and see where it all came from. And I think that's very important for what we do. And you are an amazing general. I mean, you're an amazing person.
It's never been about me, Billy. Billy, it's about the pioneers and masters. So I appreciate you saying kind things, but it's never been about me. So let me ask you a question. We're doing something. We saw a vision last year because last year we lost 7 incredible history generals.
Right.
Master June Reed, Roger Green, Roger Carpenter, Ralph Joski, Rooster Mackin, and it broke our heart. And one of the things that I know that we're doing this year, we're making a special memorial banner so people can actually say something to their friend that we've lost underneath their picture. I'm so excited about doing that.
It'll be like the big thing that everybody signs, you know, but it'll be huge and it'll have the faces of all the people we've lost. I mean, not just recently. I mean, all the way back.
Right.
And people will be able to write notes.
If you
want to
see that, you can go to sportkaratemuseum.org or sportkaratemuseumarchives.com and click on Memoriam, and you'll see everyone's listed that we lost. We list everybody.
Well, now you'll be able to see their faces and write a note to them or write memories next to their faces because I'm doing the artwork for the entire wall.
Right. That's very special. Well, let me while I got everybody on the air, I just want to go ahead and share something with you guys. You guys mostly know that I'm doing 2 Living Legends roasts this year, and the first one is in Houston, September the 27th and 28th. Billy will be there. Daryl will be actually one of the roasters, and we'll be having a History General Summit on Friday where all the History Generals will be coming in, and we'll be sharing stories and all kinds of cool stuff. Of course, we're doing the Kata Wars, which is Darlene McPherson Pagels and my vision to have an open kata tournament. But this year we're doing something very special, guys. We brought in Kevin Funakoshi and the traditional kata tournament where we'll separate Kyokushin, Shorinryu, Goju, Ichiryu, Wado Ryu, Isshinryu, all the various Okinawa Japanese styles into their separate kata divisions, take the first place kata divisions, and form a grand from the traditional people. And then they'll help go up against the Dean Piles and the Johnny Murphys and Dave Johnsons and the Karen Paredes, these incredible people that have won 100 first places of kata or more, taking their grand and forming a grand from the open pro division and facing the traditional kata division from all the traditional styles. Now, Dean Piles, you have been the second runner-up 2 years in a row, losing by 1/10 of a point 1 year. I've got to ask you, without you getting all crazy on me, Wolverine, how important is Kata Wars and important to have a Kevin Funakoshi traditional tournament where we show the separation of Okinawa and Japanese karate and the open divisions of kata? How important is that, Mr. Piles?
Oh, yeah, it's very important. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's going to be awesome just to see everybody, the different avenues and that kind of thing in the whole competition, you know, with the Japanese and then bringing them in and competing against the overall people doing weapons or whatever, you know. It's different. People got to realize how hard it is for those judges to judge that because it is so different. But you got a good
score. Well,
let's
talk about that. Wolverine, let's talk about that a minute. I don't know if Billy knows it or not. Well, Billy does. And Karen, you know about it. And Daryl, you were my mentors when I developed this with Mr. Kerbin. We don't judge 9.99, 9.98, 9.97. We threw that away. Mr. Kerbin and the mentorship of Mr. Buten and Daryl Stewart, we created a system that the judges now are a microscope. And we have five judges. One judge just watches the upper body. So there's no more sticking the little finger out when you throw a punch or bending your wrist. One judge watches the lower body and the kicks. There's no more kicking a round kick on the ball of your foot. One judge watches the application and theatrical presence or bunkai of your kata and gives you a score on your ability to perform that. One judge watches if you step out of the ring. The kung fu guys hate you. I don't care. Don't step out of the ring. The fifth judge is really the most important judge, I feel, is the technical judge. That means if you don't have good technical karate do, no matter if you're the best weapons, the best musical, the best gymnastics karate guy, as you think you are, even though you won 100 first places, you will not win kata wars if you don't have a high technical score. And I know that that's very interesting, but putting a kata person under a microscope already proving that he's a or she's a champion, it's never been done before, and it really pushes the envelope. Willie, you did something last year that kind of blew me away. You not only entered a bubble, you did a point demonstration, which is hadn't been seen in years. You did it with my son. How fun was that?
It was pretty cool. I definitely enjoyed it. And it was
something
different.
We did something different last year. We had a 3-man block built tag team.
Tag team, that was great.
And talking about rules, we had a 3-point rule. Daryl, do you remember the 3-point rule? You ran the center. Do you remember it?
You're a perfectly capable young woman, and I apologize.
Well, someone's in the background.
There's a background.
Somebody in that background. Someone's talking. Get off my radio show.
Another radio show breaking in.
Hey, this is the AMA Masters Radio Show with a bunch of NBL animals and one PKL animal.
I hear you.
What are you doing on my show? It's okay, guys. We'll just talk over them. Daryl, how do you feel about that 3-point rule that the Jim Harrison All-American Challenge has?
Well, that's a blitz, a sweep, the takedown, and a yell all at one time. I thought it was a good rule. And we had some super fantastic fights last year, and I'm looking forward to them this year.
Interesting stuff. Interesting. Well, you know, I'm doing two this year. I'm doing what they call, Black Belt Magazine called, a double Hawaiian whammy. And I'm doing my dear friend from Hawaii, John Natividad, in Las Vegas, November 1st and 2nd, after Houston, which would be September 27th and 28th. Now, I'm really excited about Las Vegas, not only because we've taken the museum to Las Vegas, Nevada, But we're going to be doing some really incredible things. We're honoring incredible people, and I'm not going to go over everything, but just give you a teaser. Today I've been on the phone with Bill Wallace, Joe Cordy, and Mr. Smith, and some other dignitaries and history generals, and got permission to honor Joe Lewis this year with a Memorial Dragon Image Fighting Award, which we do every year. And the following people will receive the Joe Lewis Memorial Dragon Image Award in Las Vegas, Nevada, November 1st and 2nd, and not in any particular order. Jerry Smith from Black Belt Magazine, Bernie Freeman, the great fighter from the 70s, Ken Firestone, the man who won the Kabuki Challenge in 17 fights one year in Las Vegas to win the world championship, the one and only Ron Martini. That's right. Ron Martini will be at the Living Legends in Las Vegas receiving the Dragon Image Award from Joe Lewis. David Brock, who he said the toughest fighter ever fought was Ishmael Robles, which we probably know that that's definitely a fact. But David ran California competition for three hard years as the number one fighter. One of the great, great fighters from the USKA, Dean Evans, Flem Evans, who was the number one fighter in USKA. Mr. Bob White, the great Kempo fighter. Bob White received the Joe Lewis Memorial Dragon Image Award. And today I got permission from Bill Wallace, Joe Corley, and Mr. Smith, the only woman that will ever be asked or ever receive the Joe Lewis Memorial Dragon Image Award, and that is the great Linda Denley. So congratulations to those people that will be honored with the Joe Lewis memory. The Ed Parker Mahalo Award in Las Vegas will be given to Mr. Art Camacho and the great Steve Cooper, who runs the Long Beach Internationals. And got some incredible speakers, Emil Farkas, Eric Lee, Mark Shuey, Karen Eden Herdman, James Woodson, Joe Cordy, Bill Wallace, Rob Mancini. All the Sherman Oak guys, Alvin Prouder, Cynthia Prouder, Roddy Serlano, Butch Togasala will perform, Mouse Krasnew. I'm excited about Las Vegas. With a History General Conference on Friday, November 1st, and then the roast on November 2nd, get your tickets by calling 713-483-0476. Call John Natividad, keep in contact with him on Facebook, or call me personally. Contact the Sport Karate Museum. And for all information, you can go to sportkaratemuseumarchives.com and contact me on Facebook. Or if you'd like to call me or directly through Facebook, my phone number, 713-483-0476, email professorgarylee@gmail.com. Well, you know, guys, I can't thank you enough for being on the show tonight. And Billy Sweeney, Dean Piles, Willie Hicks, Karen Slatcher, and Daryl Stewart. Man, you guys need to give me an award just to be able to memorize those names and be able to say them properly. I still don't know how to spell Slatcher. I promise you, I try, but I get past the L.
I had to learn making a poster.
Yeah, but I want to say something to you personally, each one of you, before I hang up. First of all, to Billy Sweeney, I remember a time when there was no medics. I remember a time there was nobody even think about going to the hospital, going to a karate tournament, and then everybody thought, where is the ambulance or where's the nearest hospital? Thank goodness for Billy Sweeney and what you've done for all the competitors that trust the fact that if they get a broken nose or hurt seriously, that you know how to handle it enough to deteriorate the pain enough that eventually the ambulance can come and they can be taken care of. So thank you from all the competitors that that you've helped. And myself, I never needed you, but I appreciate you so much each year at the Living Legends, and I do appreciate it. Karen Slatcher, all I can say to you, thank you for letting me call you at 12 o'clock at night and talk to you for an hour. And being my best friend for all these years and putting up with me after I slapped that kung fu guy at the Mississippi Black Dragon Fight Society and said he didn't deserve to be a black belt. Well, that's another story. We won't talk about that. Okay, but thank you. I love you.
I love you too.
Daryl Stewart, you put up with me for 20 years plus. And publicly, I want you to know, even though I roasted you and you've been in every one of my roasts, publicly I want you to know I forgive you for ripping those puka shells off my neck at the Yellow Rose Nationals back in 1993. Not that I remember anything or it bothers me, but I do forgive you for that. You understand? But I will never forget it. Okay. But I love you, Daryl Stewart, for what you are and what you are to support karate, knowing that we can always depend on you to make the right decision to the best of your ability, even though sometimes it's not right. you're right most of the time, but sometimes you make a decision that's controversial. So I said that in love, but I do love you, Daryl Stewart. Well, Willie Hicks, are you there?
Man. Yes, sir. I'm still here.
Willie Hicks. I got to say, Willie, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
I'm not going to get emotional. I'm not going to – well, I might cry, but I'm not going to let anybody see it because of radio.
Yeah, don't need to, Jerry.
But I'm going to tell you something.
Don't let nobody see us crying.
Listen to me. Don't interrupt the sensei. Listen to me. I gave Garrett, after I got him to the point, you know, to Wade Jenkins. Wade Jenkins took him to the Kickstart program and Chuck Norris, all that stuff. And then I gave him to Jason Holmes. And Jason Holmes took him to the level that he needed to be around, I consider, one of the greatest point fighters that I've ever witnessed, and that is you, Willie Hicks. And for the past 10 years, you've been the best friends of my son, and I've adopted you. You're family to me. I love you, Regina, as if you're my own blood. And I'm so proud that you've allowed me to be a mentor, coach, friend, father image to help you make decisions. And Cammie loves you. Garrett loves you. All my dogs love you. The guy next door is going to love you if I tell him to. I'm just telling you, you're a great guy, and I appreciate you so much. And
thank you.
Yeah. So, hey, guys, we finished another show in the can.
Hey, Gary.
This is our third year.
Gary?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
I think someone else is on. Is Master Nativadat on? I thought I heard him come in.
John, are you there?
I'm on. Yeah.
John.
There he is.
Everybody say aloha to John Nativadat, everybody.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Killer.
Aloha.
Aloha.
From Hawaii.
Aloha, Mr. Nativadat.
You guys sound good.
You do too.
No more. I could understand it better if you talk pigeon, though.
For my listeners, I have the one and only the giant killer, John Nativadat, who will be roasting in Las Vegas November 1st and 2nd. And John, I'm so glad that you called in. I'm so glad I get to talk to you and everybody gets to listen to you. Tell me how you feel about the Sport Karate Museum roasting you this year in Las Vegas.
Well, I'm glad that somebody had the vision and had the inspiration to do it. I mean, you got to save the history. You got to save the tradition. The young bucks will never know where it comes from. Where we all come from, where we all blaze the trail to make this happen.
How very true.
You know, I'm excited about it.
Well, John,
you know,
we got some family. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah. We got some great champions out there, and they'll never know who they are if we don't preserve it. We don't let them know. I mean, It just didn't happen overnight. I mean, it took years, it took time. It took a lot of bumps and bruises. It took a lot of broken ribs and things like that, blood and guts time. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, you have to know who they are to blaze a trail.
That's right.
You know, we're all the type of person that we didn't follow its trail. We made our own marks. Because we got hurt, we did it. You know, and it takes somebody like Gary Lee to hope that they save that one warrior at a time.
Amen. Amen. Thank you, John.
I'm thankful for you guys.
Amen.
I'm thankful for all you guys have the tradition and have the knowledge and keep it up.
Well, I got a couple minutes, and I got to share the story about how how John Nativity came to my life when I was a kid in Hawaii. John was already in the mainland, already making a reputation. He was bigger than life to me. Him and Ed Parker and Mike Stone were my heroes. And I was young, and I remember telling my sensei one day that I was going to go out in the woods, and I was going to practice kata, and I would be gone for about an hour. And I told him that I'd be out in the woods. He couldn't find me. I was deep in the woods, and I was going to practice kata for an hour. In reality, I hitchhiked to Honolulu to the drugstore just to get the magazine that John made the cover of. And it took me 3 hours to get to the drugstore, and took me about an hour and a half to get back. So I was gone almost 4 hours. When I got back, Sensei looked at me, and he goes, "Man, you've been practicing kata for a long time." And, of course, I took a pail of water, and I put it on my uniform. And, you know, that's not a sweat, you know. And karate people know what sweat is and know what water is. And I tried to pick up my sensei, and I put water on my face and my hair and stuff. And he says, "You must have been working out really hard. I mean, how many katas you do?" And I go, oh, hundreds. I did hundreds of katas. You know, 4 hours, sensei. And then he says, "Well, I looked for you. I couldn't find you. I went deep in the woods." I said, "Well, I was deep in the woods, sir. I told you I was really deep." And finally he says, "Where'd you really go?" And I hung my head. And I said, "Sensei, I hitchhiked to Honolulu to get this." And I pulled it out of the back of my gi, and it was all wet from the water. From the water I poured on myself to make me think I was sweaty. And I pulled it out, and he saw your picture. He saw your picture, John, and he looked at it because he knew how much I worshipped you. He looked at it. He didn't punish me. He didn't say anything. He said, "I want you to take the broom and go sweep the sand out back, please."
Yeah.
And back then, that was my punishment. I didn't have to sweep the floor. I had to sweep sand, which was the beach. So he knew what I had done, and that's how I knew then that I had to meet John Nativity, and the rest is history. So I love you, John Nativity. Thank you for being here. I love you guys, Daryl Stewart, Willie Hicks, Karen Slatcher, and Billy Sweeney, even though I hate to say it publicly, I love you too.
Wow.
I
love
you guys.
Okay.
You guys are my family. You guys are my family.
Too, Gary.
And I appreciate you so much supporting the Sport Karate Museum and all the work we do. And remember,
always
check out the Legends Weekend and Las Vegas, June the 28th and 29th, and the Who's Who in the Martial Arts, which is the base of our show that helps us produce the show every Tuesday. And so, ladies and gentlemen, from the heart, as I always say, every week for the past 3 years, mahalo.
From my heart, I thank all of you.
We thank
mahalo.
You, sir.
We thank you, sir.
Mahalo.
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 Mahalo. Mahalo.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Good night, everybody. All my
good
love.
Night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
John Boyd, good night. That it?